In 2017, before the hashtag MeToo movement exploded, Rose McGowan was already fighting. Her memoir, Brave, became a cultural lightning rod that helped ignite a global reckoning with sexual abuse in entertainment. What began as her personal battle against Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein evolved into a broader war against systemic misogyny. Oprah Winfrey called it one of the most important books of the decade, while the New York Times praised McGowan's unflinching candor. The book's release coincided with McGowan being named one of Time's Persons of the Year as a silence breaker. Beyond a celebrity memoir, Brave offers a rare insider's view of how entertainment's most powerful cult operates and how one woman found the courage to escape it. I see cults everywhere, in Kardashian fandoms, TV show obsessions, political partisanship, wellness movements, and even corporate cultures. The markers are consistent: blind devotion, suppression of individual thought, and an us versus them mentality. Anywhere with unchallenged group thought and charismatic leadership, you're in a cult. The first step to freedom is recognizing your captivity. I should know, I've escaped from two iconic cults, and the scars run deep. Born in a stone barn in Tuscany, I entered the world delivered by a blind midwife on an Italian duke's estate, a beginning that seems lifted from a dark fairy tale. My first cult was literal, the Children of God, where I was named Rosa Ariana, a name that carried the weight of their expectations. From my earliest memories, I recall the terrifying cult leader Moses, David Berg, sending cartoon directives called Mo letters that dictated everything from daily routines to sexual practices. These illustrated missives arrived like sacred texts, and followers would gather in reverent circles to study them, debating their meanings with an intensity usually reserved for biblical scholars. Despite being surrounded by true believers who spoke in tongues and claimed divine visions, I instinctively protected my inner self, building invisible walls between my thoughts and their doctrine. When a ghostly woman in white, one of the cult's spiritual enforcers, demanded I let God into my heart during a midnight ceremony, I repeatedly refused, despite physical punishment that left bruises. This defiance became my pattern, a survival mechanism that would serve me well in years to come. The cult grew increasingly dangerous with the introduction of flirty fishing, sending young women as hookers for Jesus to seduce men into joining. My father, with his magnetic personality and theatrical flair, thrived in this highly sexualized environment, becoming a star recruiter. When the cult began advocating child-adult sex through Berg's infamous law of love, my father finally drew the line. One night, with the kind of dramatic flair that characterized his parenting, he told us a man was after us with a hammer, and we fled to another Italian town, leaving my mother behind. Just one more destabilization in a childhood built on shifting sands. In public school, I was immediately labeled different, marked by my strange clothes and stranger worldview. I couldn't relate to normal children's concerns about homework and playground politics when my daily thoughts revolved around apocalyptic prophecies and spiritual survival. Walking to school, I'd hold elaborate funerals for dead insects, arriving puffy-eyed from crying over their tiny souls. My emotional intensity and preoccupation with death unnerved people then as it does now. Though my father had physically left the Children of God, his psychological need to be worshipped remained deeply ingrained. He was essentially a cult leader without a flock, creating his own miniature kingdom in our home. My consistent refusal to worship him was deeply unsettling to his ego, creating a pattern of conflict that would follow us across the ocean to America, where new forms of captivity awaited. My first glimpse of myself in a mirror happened on the plane taking me to America. I had no attachment to the face staring back at me, unaware I was about to enter a world of gender limitations, what you can't do because you're a girl. Going from Florence, Italy to Gig Harbor, Washington was like moving from the cradle of Western civilization to a land of rednecks and jacked-up trucks. America terrified me. Loud, jarring, with terrible food and aggressive people. On my first day of American school, I was forced to lead the Pledge of Allegiance, which I didn't know. When the teacher remarked this would get the communist out of her, I responded with just one word, fascistas. The message was clear. You're different, and we must crush that difference out of you. Despite the myth of American individualism, true individuals are persecuted. Schools force-feed propaganda versions of history until you graduate chanting, "America, hell yes, white men are number one." But America isn't number one in anything except obesity, firearm deaths, incarceration rates, and military might. Instead of feeling superior because other places are worse, we should simply strive to be better. After a brief stay in Colorado, I moved to Oregon to live with my mother. Far from the peace-loving hippie paradise people imagine, I encountered vicious people with jacked-up trucks, gun racks, and dead deer hanging from carports. My new stepfather, Steve, a mean dry drunk, convinced my mother I was a drug addict simply because I wore black and listened to the Doors. At 13, I was locked in a drug rehab program at Sacred Heart Hospital, my shoes confiscated to prevent escape. When I told doctors I'd only taken acid once, they said I was in denial. The rehab was both entertaining and monotonous. They taught us about drugs for hours each day, street names, values, effects, everything you'd want to know. I escaped twice, the second time for good, beginning my life as a runaway. Being homeless in Oregon meant constant rain, wet clothes, and gnawing hunger. I'd sometimes experience strange blackouts, dissociating from my body during difficult moments. My father's psychological warfare was relentless and calculated. Almost daily, he would say things like, "I can't imagine anybody would ever want to be your friend," or "I can't imagine anybody liking you." The word whore became his favorite weapon, wielded with precise cruelty at every opportunity. Though intellectually I recognized these as lies, his words were like acid rain, slowly eroding my sense of self. One particularly violent night, he discovered me in my closet bedroom, a tiny space I'd claimed as my sanctuary, and grabbed me by the neck. As he dragged me across the floor, his threat to staple your tongue to the floor came because I dared mention calling the police. The memory of his fingers on my throat stayed with me for years. In response, I created the Death Monologue, written by flashlight in the dead of night. It was a meticulous catalog of my father's transgressions, each word carefully chosen, each sentence crafted to maximum effect. I planned to read it before ending his life with a meat mallet from our kitchen. The irony wasn't lost on me that the very perfectionism the cult had instilled, the need to get everything exactly right, ultimately prevented me from carrying out this plan. I revised that monologue countless times, never satisfied with its impact. The outside world brought its own form of torture. At 13, my body became a target for constant male attention. I couldn't walk to the corner store without enduring a barrage of honking cars, whistles, and crude gestures. This sexual harassment created a profound dissociation. I began experiencing myself as two distinct entities, the internal self that screamed in protest, and the external self that men consumed with their eyes. At the library, I spent hours researching breast reduction surgery, desperate for invisibility. Eventually, I developed psychological blinders, like those worn by carriage horses, teaching myself to stare straight ahead and block out the harassment. When my father suddenly demanded $300 monthly rent, raw panic set in. The specter of homelessness, something I'd experienced before, loomed large, bringing back memories of that gnawing hunger when your stomach literally consumes itself. A chance discovery of a flyer advertising $35 daily pay seemed like divine intervention. This led to my role in Class of 1999, a B-movie where I played a background gang member. The experience turned dark when a middle-aged man on set befriended me, only to sexually assault me in his hotel room where I'd gone expecting to meet other extras. I filed this trauma away in a mental box, not recognizing it as assault until years later. At the time, I simply labeled it a sexual experience and pushed forward. Through this film, I connected with a young actor whose mother became my unexpected savior, facilitating my journey to Hollywood, where I eventually secured a speaking role in Encino Man. The culmination of this period came at 15, when I stood in court seeking emancipation from my parents. My pantyhose were running, my heart was pounding, but my voice remained steady as I argued for my freedom, finally breaking free from years of systematic abuse. My entry into acting came unexpectedly when a producer approached me outside a Los Angeles gym. She was working with independent director Greg Araki and offered me an audition for The Doom Generation. After careful consideration, I accepted the opportunity when learning it offered sufficient compensation to cover living expenses and enable international travel. My motivation wasn't driven by artistic passion, but rather by a desire for independence and new experiences beyond my familiar Pacific Northwest environment. The initial screen test revealed concerning industry practices. The audition process included inappropriate physical contact that left me feeling professionally compromised. I coped by emotionally detaching, a psychological response I would later understand as a protective mechanism. Despite these challenges, I secured the role of Amy Blue. I developed the character by drawing from my authentic teenage experiences, channeling adolescent defiance into a compelling performance that resonated within independent cinema. During production, I encountered unprofessional conduct from a co-star who claimed method acting as justification for boundary violations. When I reported this behavior, production leadership dismissed my concerns with inappropriate casualness, exemplifying how certain behaviors were normalized in the industry. Years later, when discussing these experiences publicly, my account faced attempts at invalidation, a common pattern of minimizing workplace misconduct. The professional demands of acting in Hollywood presented constant challenges. Auditions often felt demeaning. Industry gatekeepers maintained a facade of professionalism while conducting evaluations in ways that felt inappropriate. The process involved hours of preparation, waiting alongside numerous other candidates, only to perform emotional scenes in stark environments before predominantly male executives. Each audition left me feeling diminished, disposing of scripts afterward in an attempt to process these experiences. The casting process for Scream highlighted industry power dynamics. Despite an initial offer, studio leadership required multiple additional screen tests after my representation negotiated for fair compensation. A casual comment about potentially changing my hair color revealed troubling industry standards. Female characters were often differentiated primarily by appearance rather than character depth. Though inauthentic to my preferences, adapting to these expectations became necessary for professional advancement in a system that often reduced performers to interchangeable visual elements. In 1997, while filming Phantoms for Miramax, I was sent to Sundance with four films premiering. After one screening, my manager Jill excitedly told me the studio head had summoned me to a 10 a.m. business meeting at his hotel restaurant. She insisted I go, describing him as a known star maker with incredible power. The next morning, with an MTV crew filming A Day in the Life of Rose McGowan, I smiled at the camera and said, "I think my life is finally getting easier." The crew waited outside while I entered the hotel. The grim-faced restaurant host told me the studio head was working from his suite and I should go up. The hotel room was actually an entire floor, about 3,000 square feet. The studio head was on a huge couch, talking loudly on the phone. I was immediately repulsed by his appearance. Large, with oily skin, a pockmarked face, bulbous nose, and liver lips. He reminded me of a melted pineapple, the bogeyman of nightmares. After his call ended, I tried to impress him with my intelligence, thinking we were plotting the grand arc of my career. I was naive, believing this was a legitimate business meeting. When he mentioned having a jacuzzi, I thought it was just a tacky brag about being rich. As we wrapped up, he offered to walk me out. In the hallway, he pushed me inside a tiny jacuzzi room. Everything happened so fast. My clothes were peeled off. I was picked up and placed on the edge of the jacuzzi, naked and terrified. I froze like a statue, disassociating as he pushed my legs apart and violated me. To escape, I faked an orgasm. It worked. He told me to get dressed, and I stumbled out in shock to the waiting MTV cameras. My co-star's response when I told him where I'd been, "God damn it, I told him to stop doing that," haunts me to this day. When I sought justice, I was betrayed at every turn. My manager suggested it would help my career. A powerful agent admitted he'd just killed an exposé about the studio head in the LA Times. A criminal attorney dismissed me. "You're an actress. You've done a sex scene. You'll never win." I was blacklisted across Hollywood as bad news, while my most vulnerable moment became industry gossip. After 2 hours of being transformed into a plastic doll version of myself, I'm driven to the red carpet in an ice-cold car. As we approach, I hear the screaming crowds. My entire body shakes with stress, knowing I'm about to subject myself to global scrutiny and inevitable online savagery. This isn't about celebrating my work. It's about preparing to be judged and torn apart. The photographers, mostly men, scream my name aggressively as I mince down the carpet in painful heels and heavy fake eyelashes. Over the shoulder, they demand, wanting to capture both my face and my ass in the same shot. I comply, turning as instructed, reduced to a piece of meat to be consumed, savaged, and judged. This is considered part of my job. I was exhausted from working to survive since childhood, never experiencing a moment without stomach-knotting worry. As a child, my dream vacation was simply a week in a hospital where no one could hurt me and I could have all the pudding I wanted. My dogs, Bug and Fester, became my lifeline during this dark post-assault period. Then, Marilyn Manson entered my life. Despite his shocking public persona, the reality was completely different. While the world thought he was boiling puppies and worshiping Satan, he was actually painting watercolors of my Boston Terriers while I shopped for Martha Stewart glassware. During our first year together, he helped patch me back together after my assault, showing extraordinary kindness when I was waking up screaming with night terrors. Our relationship faced opposition from all sides. His manager and bandmates claimed I was making him soft, while Hollywood casting directors and agents were horrified by my association with him. Years later, when a CAA agent asked why I dated that freak, I delivered a scathing rebuke about creativity and artistic worth versus their empty, suited existence. My most notorious moment came at the 1998 MTV Video Music Awards, where I wore the infamous naked dress, not to be sexy, but as a punk statement and reclamation of my body after assault. It was a middle finger to the media that objectified me, though the subsequent global slut-shaming missed my point entirely. Looking back, I wish I had known I was an artist sooner. I would have started directing, singing, and writing much earlier. But there were no examples to look to. I couldn't see what I could become because it didn't exist. And the cult doesn't want you to know your value or that you're free. I started with small steps, getting physically healthy, then healing mentally. I have cyclothymia, which makes me prone to depressions that rocketed after my assault. I now manage it with mood stabilizers. There's no shame in this. Finding the right medical protocol can be life-changing, like raising blinds on your windows to feel the sun again. After my father died from pulmonary fibrosis, nothing mattered. I entered a haze, watching classic films and spending time with my dogs. Slowly, I began transforming from a beaten-down individual to a strong woman who knows her worth. I worked hard on myself, fusing the many characters I'd played into one whole person, me. My friend Joshua Miller and his writing partner approached me saying simply, "It's time. Time for me to direct my own movie." They wrote a brilliant script for a short film called Dawn, where I explored what happens when we send girls into society trained only to be polite. On set, I kept waiting for nerves to kick in, as they did when acting, but they never came. Directing felt as natural as breathing. I'd finally found something I loved. Ashton Kutcher inadvertently got me involved with social media when he said Twitter is the only voice an actor can actually have. One night, my agency sent me an Adam Sandler script with a wildly demeaning cover letter specifying tank top and tight jeans for the audition. I posted a photo of these instructions on social media and woke to discover my tweet had gone viral worldwide. This was my awakening, pulling out the threads of Hollywood's misogyny, sexism, and brainwashing to free my own mind. Let me address entertainment as male propaganda. Can you imagine if man's history was only depicted through a woman's perspective? Has there ever been a film where only women were hired to tell a man's story? No. We rarely discuss this because women are accustomed to table scraps. Women are mirrored back to ourselves almost exclusively through men's ideas of what we are, gender appropriation in the extreme. The Directors Guild of America is 96% male and has been since 1946. Your entire lives, you've consumed a steady diet of male thought and bias about what women are and can be. This systemic misogyny persists without government oversight. Film and television remain a white male's playground, and through their narrow vision comes the manipulated mirror we're forced to see ourselves in. In 2016, only 23% of speaking roles on screen were women, mostly in horror films where we know how they're treated. This matters profoundly. It's how we form notions about ourselves and others, poisoning us in ways we don't always recognize. I urge you to watch what you consume. Notice stereotypes and cliches, reject them, complain, tweet at directors and studios. Most importantly, demand more. Your mind is at stake. I challenge directors to stop their infantile tantrums and boys' club entitlement. Stop treating women as props to attract male viewers. Most of you make mediocre films because you lack empathy and multitasking skills, classically female strengths. Women in the industry, build your own table. Female producers, stop coddling male directors and invest in women writers and directors. Actresses, you are artists, not commodities. Refuse demeaning roles, demand equal pay, walk out of exploitative auditions. Men must recognize they're the number one danger to women, children, animals, and the planet. Your privilege starts from birth. Even in the worst situations, you're still considered better than a woman. Break free from Hollywood's false ideals of masculinity. Women, stop apologizing for existing. Occupy space. Aren't you tired of having your value tied to your looks? Support other women. If you're called bitter or a man-hater for fighting equality, know I've survived every name in the book. Feminism simply means supporting equal rights and pay. It's your humanity. Being brave doesn't mean you're not scared. It means doing the scary thing anyway. Challenge what you consume, demand better from those pushing damaging narratives, and refuse to buy what they're selling. Our lives and minds are at stake. You can change the world just by being brave.